You are listening to WDOT Radio Port Washington. Welcome back to another fantastic school year at Schreiber. This year's first interviewee on the Epic Entertainment Roundup is Abraham Chang. He is an award-winning published poet and obtained his MFA from NYU Creative Writing Program. He started his career in publishing in 2000 and is currently a sales manager at Simon & Schuster's Special Markets Division. 888 Love and the Divine Burden of Numbers is his new debut novel, now for sale. Please give him a warm welcome to the show. Abraham Chang, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Hi, Gabriel. Thank you so much for having me. And I'll correct you on one thing that has changed in my bio since it was actually published. I actually left my job at Simon & Schuster to become a writer full-time. So that is one major difference in my official author bio.
Oh, wow. Do you like that change?
Yes and no. I love my job at Simon & Schuster. I love doing what I did at the special sales department. Basically, we did kind of bulk sales for books. I work with literacy programs. I've worked with HR departments, a lot of kind of educational stuff. I loved my job, but it just was not, I couldn't juggle that with my blossoming career on the other side of the fence as a writer full time. So if I had to choose one or the other, I'm going to choose being a writer 100% of the time.
Well, I guess it's good that you became a full time author, as this book, that your new book sounds amazing.
Thank you so much, Gabriel. Yes, my new book, since I'm a debut author, nobody really knows who I am. So I have to kind of do what I can to get attention on me as an author and on my debut book. And it's been getting a fantastic notice through, you know, all of these major media outlets like the New York Times. Barnes & Noble has been really supportive of it. I wrote an article recently in Esquire that's kind of the behind the scenes of some of the issues I was going through as I was writing this novel. And it was in Hudson News for the entire month of May, in airports and train stations, and lots of local indie bookstores. You might know some of these. They supported it because it was a indie next pick, which is a great honor. It's like the top 25 books that the indie bookstores across the country support. So that was a really thrilling kind of spring and summer release time for me.
Yeah, I was on a teen tour this summer, and I sent it to you. I went to Powell's Books, and I walk in, and I see a huge display for your book, and I'm like, oh my God, Mom, I have to send this to him.
Yeah, that is such a thrill. And Powell's, for people, your listeners who don't know, Powell's is one of the biggest, most well-respected independent bookstores out in the Portland, Oregon area. And it's such a dream of mine to have that kind of support, because those indie bookstores, those indie booksellers, they really know what they're doing. And to have their kind of support is just overwhelming. It's such a great honor to know that those booksellers who read everything are behind, giving their seal of approval on my little debut novel. So I really appreciate it. And so glad that you and your mom were able to see that while we were traveling.
Yeah, it was great to see. So I want to start off the show today by just asking you to tell me a little about yourself, well, and a little about your childhood growing up.
Sure. I was an American-born Chinese kid, born and raised in Queens. Like you mentioned, I do know your mom. Your mom and I, we kind of grew up in the same area. I went to junior high school at Ryan Junior High School. I don't know if it's still called Ryan Junior High School 216. That's what, you know, we knew it as when we were growing up. And for us in that area, kind of the Fresh Meadows area of Queens, is very diverse background. So I got to see a lot of different ethnicities and languages and beliefs kind of growing up. And, you know, we loved it in the 80s and 90s. So at that time, it was just a really, you know, I would take a page out of an old ad, you know, what we used to call the United Colors of Benetton. It's an old famous ad for clothing back then, where it was kind of every color, every nationality was kind of represented. And that's kind of how I felt about my childhood growing up. And a lot of that is reflected in the novel that I wrote. Even though it's fiction, a lot of it is based on kind of what was actually my experience growing up in the 80s and 90s as an Asian American kid in New York City.
Did you read a lot growing up in Queens?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Growing up, I spent a lot of time in the library. You know, I was that kid who the librarian was always like, asking, should you be reading Stephen King at such a young age, young man, kind of thing. So, I was very precocious. I'd love to read whatever I could. Everything from, choose your own adventure books to, the horror novels of Stephen King and John Saul, reading the Chronicles of Narnia, things like that. And that, of course, comic books and graphic novels. That's what I really grew up on.
Well, I do theater. I was just in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and I was Edmund.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, it was a fun time. So, you reading these books when you were growing up, is this how you knew that you wanted to become an author, or was that later down in the road?
Well, for me growing up, I always thought that, I was very lucky that my family was always very encouraging of our love of the written word. My grandfather on my mother's side was a famous journalist who was in China and then over to Taiwan. So, when he came over to the States, he brought his entire family. And, we grew up knowing that he was a famous journalist, that he had a deep love of words, and he encouraged us to kind of, really study hard and kind of read as much as we could. So we grew up bilingual, but, being born, I was the first grandchild born in the States. And, knowing this about my family history, and knowing that we had this kind of inheritance of the written word in whatever language, for me it was English, and reading, the stories that I read and loved in the English language. So growing up with that deep love, no matter where it was coming from, it was, deeply ingrained in me and my entire family.
Did you ever write for like the school newspaper or a local newspaper?
Oh, yes. So a real funny thing is, thank goodness for social media. Thank goodness for, Facebook and, before that, MySpace and Friendster. So we connect with old friends, but also you can connect with your old teachers, which is amazing. Because on Facebook now, I have some people that are connected to me who are actually my elementary school teachers. And one of my elementary school, my beloved elementary school teacher, Mrs. Bodanos, she actually had some old clippings, and some of my classmates from that time, they had old clippings of our school newspaper and our school kind of magazines. They had some old articles that I wrote when I was in fourth or fifth or sixth grade, and it was just funny to kind of look back on the stuff that I was writing about back then when I was a kid. But a lot of that is just such a great nostalgic pin in your life where there's milestones of, I knew back when that I had this love for writing and creativity. And, look at me now, I've been able to foster that, going on into middle age with the same love of the things that I cherished back then. A lot of it's the same. A lot of it is the sci-fi, the pop culture, the robots, the superheroes, things from when I was a kid that I truly loved, I still love today.
Do you remember your first piece of writing? Did you see that first piece of writing when you connected with your teacher?
I don't necessarily remember the exact first piece of writing, but, my parents, they come to all of these book events, and, when I'm talking about my journey as a writer and as a novelist, they're always proud of me no matter what, but they remind me that, when I was young, I would write book reports in Star Wars, and they'd be so, proud of me getting my, A in on my paper, that that's something that they carry with them to this day, even though I've had many more accomplishments since then. But ever since I was little, I was always involved in writing and doing well in that space, either for school reports or being more creative, writing little short stories, or, you know, as I'm going through school, you know, writing poetry or writing other forms of fiction. It's just something that I kind of nursed and built my skills on through the years.
So you were talking about Mrs. Bodeanus and your family a lot. Did you have any other mentors throughout your career?
Oh, yes, so many. I mean, from people from elementary school, junior high school, all the way through, people at work. The real mentor I would have, if I was going to speak to one person, I'll tell you a little story that, you know, when I went for my MFA in creative writing at NYU, I was if you read my book, you'll know that my thoughts on coincidence and things that just kind of happen, you know kind of what side of the fence I sit on. And I believe that, you know, there is a bit of fate in everybody's lives and that certain things do happen for a reason. And one of those is how I came across my real mentor. At the time when I was applying for the program, these MFA programs, they have rotating staff every few years. And depending on what program you're applying to, you'll get a certain group of professors who tend to be very well-respected writers. And my first choice was NYU. And I did not realize that my favorite living poet of all time was going to be there during my 2 years of grad school. And it just so happened that Philip Levine was my favorite poet and is still one of my favorite poets. And he was going to be teaching during my MFA program. And he became my real legitimate mentor. And I had 2 years of him just kind of helping me hone my poetry, helping me hone my work. And I was such a fan of his because the type of writing he wrote, his poetry was very kind of down to earth, very blue collar, talking about everyday things, but in a beautiful, elevated way. And I loved his writing for that. And I felt a kinship because a lot of the stuff that I wanted to write about was not this highfalutin kind of stuff. It was very much, you know, things about the subway, riding the subway in New York City, how you felt, or going on an elliptical machine at the gym and what's going through your mind, or falling asleep on a church pew, or writing, you know, about, you know, the conflicting emotions you have about cockroaches, how they're so disgusting, but you're fascinated by these creatures that, you know, plague your lives as a resident of New York City, things like that. Those were the types of themes that I wrote in my poetry. And a lot of that, was similar to kind of what Phil wrote about his life in, growing up, in different places. And, I was very, very lucky that he was my mentor for those 2 years.
Yeah, I just want to add on to that for my listeners. If you don't know who Philip Levine is, he wrote about Simple Pleasures, Profound Grief, American Manliness, and he actually won the Pulitzer Prize in 1994, and I think that's so amazing that you got to work with him.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely.
So I also, when looking at your bio and researching a little about you, I also saw you worked with Galway Kinnell, Sharon Olds, and Donald Hall. How did you get involved with them?
These were also professors and, you know, really esteemed poets and writers at the NYU program. You know, it is one of the top creative writing programs, and no less than these folks, many of them passed away, most of them have passed away, were there to workshop and teach me about the craft. I went into grad school as a fresh undergraduate with little life experience. So just sitting in those classes, listening to people who are a little bit older, who live life, my colleagues and my professors there, you know, I learned so much from them and just kind of living and working out in the world kind of informed my writing today.
Mm-hmm. Is being a writer stressful?
Being a writer, it's a different kind of stress, I would say. A lot of that is imposed on yourself, and you spend a lot of time alone, spend a lot of time thinking, a lot of time puzzling out things of, you know, this should go there, this should go there. Oh, this moment makes sense, you know, but where does it fit? And, you know, there's a famous saying of killing your darlings. Basically, you're writing something that you're very enamored with your own language and how it sounds, but then for some reason or other, it doesn't fit the story or doesn't fit that chapter. And, you know, your editor says you're going to have to trim. And some of the things that you have to do is painful because you have to kind of edit to make the story as best as possible. And sometimes that means killing some of the things that you consider your favorite pieces of writing. And, you know, oftentimes I'll save those bits into a separate file. And, you know, because I can't give them up necessarily. And I hope that there's life for them somewhere else, either as a bonus scene or bonus material for something that you can use later on, or just something that can transform into a different, you know, sentence for a different piece down the line somewhere. But it is stressful that you're dealing with this creativity and you're fighting your own battles in your own head sometimes.
Mm-hmm. And before you started writing, like, your book, you wrote poetry for a long time, and I read that your poetry was set to a large mix of hard rock, indie, folk, electronica, and pop punk. Why did you set your poetry up in that way?
Well, that's more of my songwriting. So I spent almost 10 years kind of playing music in the New York City bar scene. So a lot of, you know, my poetry became song lyrics in that kind of way. And that's the kind of music that I enjoy. And that's kind of the music that I played when I played bars and stuff. You know, this is a lifetime ago when I was playing and singing there. But, you know, a lot of that is you know, love songs or songs about heartbreak, and less of the academic poetry that I used to write. So it's a little bit different, you know, music, but song lyrics can be considered poetry. And it's a different kind of beast because you have the melody and harmony that kind of conveys certain emotions that necessarily the words might not. So I think it's slightly different, but in the same, you know, realm of creativity.
Did you ever want to be a musician instead of a writer?
I mean, I think that is kind of what I was concentrating on a lot when I was a little bit younger, in my 20s and my 30s. You know, it's a much harder kind of world to be in because, you know, there's thousands of writers and there's thousands of musicians, but at the same time, you're getting that immediate feedback out in the world when you're playing on a stage or you're producing music, you know, in front of an audience. So there is that immediate gratification of getting the audience and winning an audience over through that form of creative outlet. But, you know, writing long form and being a novelist was something that, you know, I came around to a little bit later in life. It was something that it was always kind of in the back of my mind, but I think I needed to go through a different eras, if you will. That's the hot word right now. And my era as a singer-songwriter, it was necessary for me to kind of grow up a little bit until I was mature enough to kind of collect my thoughts about the similar material into a long-form fiction form of, you know, creativity work and piece that kind of storytelling into something a little bit longer and more cohesive rather than a 4 or 5 minute song about, you know, very similar subject matter.
Mm-hmm. And you were talking about the hardships of the music industry. Is it hard to be successful in the writing industry?
Absolutely. It's one of the hardest industries to kind of break into to find success, because I was on the other side of you know, the fence in terms of working in the publishing world for almost, you know, 20 plus years. You know, I started off in the editorial side of things in textbook publishing, and then, you know, I did new business development and sales for the trade publishing side of things, and most recently, like we discussed, in Simon & Schuster. So I've seen how difficult it can be from the other side, where we're part of the machine behind the authors, helping them be successful. And it takes literally takes a village to help authors break through a lot of that in order for them to get a chance to get their materials out into the world where people can read it and kind of decide for themselves. Because there's so many different avenues of publishing now. There's, publishing digitally, publishing through, self-published books. And there's success stories in kind of every possible way. But really the traditional sense of publishing where a publisher and, bookstores and, people like Barnes & Noble who support these books and get it out into the world, giving them their stamp of approval and saying, we think this is a book worthy of attention, and getting all the reviewers and the trade magazines, getting, these advanced copies for them to review. It really takes a whole army of people to kind of help you. And it really starts with somebody who champions you of, we believe this book is a great book that stands for something, and it deserves that readership. So it's very, very difficult.
Do you have any opinions on self-publishing versus traditional?
Well, I think self-publishing, there are a lot of benefits. It's that, if you have written a book and you want it in your hands, if you have the money and the time and the effort and you're willing to put in the work, you can do it yourself and you will have that book in your hands and ready to show your friends and family. Self-publishing can, there are certain, huge authors like maybe 10, 15 years ago who self-published themselves and later went on to become big media sensations because of their own success. But a lot of it is your own hustle of your, getting that out into the world, getting people to read it, and getting people to, spread the word. Word of mouth is difficult. And there's so much stuff out there that is competing for everyone's attention at the moment. It's hard to break through that noise. And, for me, as a debut writer, nobody knows who I am. I don't have, a TikTok or anything. Or a huge social media presence. So it's kind of like you're going to have to come to my book based on the synopsis of you want to read a literary love story set in the 80s and 90s with a primarily Asian-American cast. And it's a rom-com, but it's also a little bit deeper. It deals with mental health and it deals with spiritual health. It has a ton of pop culture. And, that's my elevator pitch. If I self-published it, I could try to get that in front of lots of readers, but it helps that I have a big publishing company and they believed in me enough that they paid me for it. So they paid for the publishing, they paid for the publicity and marketing, so they're behind it. So I'm very grateful, very thankful that was the path I took. But if I didn't have that experience, if I had to go the self-publishing route, if I tried to get a traditional publishing deal and I couldn't, self-publishing guarantees that, my dream of holding my own book in my hands is just a matter of, hard work and, a little bit of cash to get that done.
So we've been talking about it a little, but now I really want to get into your new book, 888 Love and the Divine Burden of Numbers. And you were talking a little about your inspiration before. Could you tell me a little bit more?
Sure. This book, I think it encapsulates everything that I wanted to read in a book. So if you told me what is the perfect book for me to read as a reader, as somebody who loves pop culture, this is kind of everything that I put into it. I tell people that, this is the type of book that is closer to The Breakfast Club than The Joy Luck Club. The 80s and 90s rom-coms. If you saw movies like Reality Bites or Singles or anything from like John Hughes, George Lucas, Steven Spielberg, and you set that in the context where there is more diversity in the cast, where there is, a love story, where there is... some elements of dealing with mental health and, specifically OCD, and putting that into a blender where you're seeing all these influences where there's cameos from these film directors and dream sequences where all the chapters start with soundtrack highlights to set the mood that you're getting, an official Spotify playlist of music that you can play while you're reading the book. And that, you know, I describe this as kind of a 7-layer dip. You know, if you want to enjoy the sour cream and the guacamole of the love story and understanding where the main character and his love interest are going, and if they really do have a true love for the ages, the epic love that he's looking for, that is one layer. But if you want to go even deeper, and you're going to get the pop culture references, all the Stephen King references in that one chapter, you know, everything from The Dark Tower to It, and how that reflects upon that scary yet sexy time in the main character's life when he's dealing with this one of his past loves, and he's dealing with a major life event, and he's reflecting on it in a way that is, he's so attracted to this woman, but at the same time he's terrified of her. And the only way that it kind of comes out in the book is all these Stephen King and scary references. So there's a lot of metatextual and textual stuff there that if you're looking for it, you'll be able to enjoy it more if you are willing to kind of look into the music and the movies and the film and the comic books and the TV shows of that era, or you're from that Gen X era and you're attracted to looking at that from a retro fresh point of view, where things aren't necessarily nostalgic, but they will kind of ring true for you if you think that the Smashing Pumpkins and Nirvana and the Pixies are, and Depeche Mode is like the soundtrack of your life. So, you know, for me, I think, you know, I always tell people I wrote this book for the bookworms, for the pop culture geeks and the hopeless romantics. And like, if you love Star Wars and you love Gilmore Girls and you love Buffy the Vampire Slayer and you love Quentin Tarantino, this is the kind of book for you. So,
well, it seems as if there's so many ideas in this book, and I just have to ask, did you ever have any like writer's block or any writing issues while developing it?
Well, you know, the origins story of this novel really dates back to, you know, over 20 years ago. This is like my pandemic baby. And I always tell people that, you know, the original ideas for this book were cobbled together from 20 plus odd years of writing in the back of, you know, meeting notebooks, where I should have been paying attention to a meeting. Instead, I was writing down an idea for a piece of writing or something that I was going to get back to at some point. So, you know, a lot of these ideas were bits and pieces from, you know, numerous 90-minute sessions around a long table where somebody was talking about something else and I just couldn't pay attention. I decided to scribble, some ideas in the back. So much of this was born out of a little bit of frustration, born out of, you know, where am I going with my career? You know, this job became a career for me, and that, you know, I wanted an excuse to get back to my first love of, you know, why I went into the publishing industry was, you know, I had my degree and I didn't know what to do with a degree. And like a degree in, in creative writing and poetry, what is the next best thing to do is like you get a job in publishing. And that job, you know, blink and it's 20 years later. And, you know, you wanted to be a writer back then, but never really got around to it. And the pandemic, while we were all kind of figuring out remote work and trying to juggle, you know, our lives and figuring out how to survive, you know, when we're not guaranteed a tomorrow, that's the best time to, you know, put the pedal to the metal and like pull out that manuscript you had in the drawer and just like, you know, wake up and like, you're not going to get another chance like this. You know, lose some sleep, you know, you need 15 minutes for lunch, get on that meeting, do your job. And then in your spare time, this is what you do. You know, you go for long walks in your neighborhood, you think of ideas. And then when you get home, you try to write as much as possible, whatever you can. So this was my pandemic baby.
Hmm. And this might be the most serious question I'm going to ask you tonight, okay?
Ooh.
So, if your book was to be adapted into a film or series, who would you cast as the lead roles?
So the lead roles, you know, they're all, you know, young Wang, he is, you know, we find him as a sophomore at NYU, and his love that he meets at the time, Erina, is about the same age. So I would have to say they'd be unknowns, as well as his best friend, Paris, who is Indian American, and Gina, who is Filipina. So they would be unknowns in their 20s. But Young's uncle, who he calls Susu, he's a little bit older. He's, you know, funny. He's, you know, he plays with different types of facial hair. He grows his hair. He cuts his hair, trying on different looks. He works on cars. He rides his Harley. And he has a great sense of humor, and he loves the ladies. So he's very atypical. He's a strong Asian role model. And for me, I always thought it would be Simu Liu or Ronnie Chang would be great in that role for his uncle. And then, you know, midway through the book, when, you know, I don't want to, mild spoilers, Young, he gets a chance to go to China. And while he's in China, he's experiencing his, you know, his parents' homeland for the first time. And he's very conflicted of, you know, do I feel like I belong here? Like, you know, I'm not really, you know, a mainland Chinese person, but, you know, back home in the States, I'm not completely accepted as, you know, a Chinese American boy. So, you know, where do I fit? Do I feel American? Do I feel Chinese? I'm kind of caught in between, and I'm dealing with, you know, working out my feelings as a young man for, you know, a young woman at the time. So while he's there, he meets a woman who is a tour guide who actually gives him some really great sisterly advice. And, you know, this woman who is in China as this, you know, very brash, very bold kind of tour guide gives him some straight advice on how to deal with, you know, growing up and being a strong male and figuring it out for himself. And, you know, I always thought there was a comedian named Zhao Ying Summers. She's hilarious. She's very dirty in her jokes, but I think she'd be a great Vicky, the tour guide. So those would probably be my fan cast for, you know, where I am currently, but it could change. Fingers crossed, hopefully, that we're going to get a film or TV series adaptation one of these days.
Mm-hmm. And you're talking about how you're a fan of some, you know, TVs and films. And what's your most memorable interaction you've had with a fan of your own?
A fan of my own? Oh, my goodness. That is something that I've come across since the book was published. I've just been so humbled and honored to have people contact me through Instagram or through my website and just, you know, tell me how much they love the book. You know, a lot of my goal was to represent the immigrant and Asian American experience in a light of pure joy. A lot of books out there are telling important stories of like generational trauma or going through a really heavy subject matter. And for me, you know, I always tell people, like the most traumatic thing that happens in this book is you know, a young man dealing with heartbreak and spoilers, you know, STD. So that's probably the most traumatic thing that happens in the book. So I'm really glad that a lot of people came to it, you know, no matter what their background is, that, you know, Asian American or not, a lot of folks have found joy in the book, especially in such a tough time that we're facing in the world right now. And, you know, in particular, one person shared that their wife was going through cancer treatment, and a lot of it was a lot of dark times, and they turned to my book for that kind of moment of peace and for some light moments and to just, you know, have a laugh and to look at things that weren't so serious and just to enjoy the read. A lot of times, you know, we forget that reading should be enjoyable, it should be fun, and I think, you know, if we learn something out of it, you know, great, you know, if there's a deeper meaning behind it, you know, fantastic, but, you know, overall, the reading experience should be enjoyable. Glad I was able to bring that reader, you know, some joy and some lightness in an otherwise dark time.
And to end today's show out, could you just share some advice for any aspiring authors listening?
Sure, absolutely. For aspiring writers and authors out there, I always tell them the most important thing is the tried and true advice of write what you know. But when you're writing what you know, unless you're writing nonfiction or memoir, consider everything fiction. You know, have it serve your story. If something that actually happened in real life is just too crazy to fit in your story, then by all means, change it. You are the author. You are the writer. Unless you're calling it nonfiction, everything is fiction. So you can write what you know, but from a different angle. You know, tell the truth, but, you know, maybe it's a little bit flavored differently. And you can always go back and edit things. But, you know, everything should serve that story and keep that storyteller's mentality in mind and have everything, have all of your tools at your disposal, including being able to bend the truth a little bit to tell the story better.
Well, Abraham, I want to thank you so much for coming on to the show tonight.
Thank you so much, Abraham, for having me. It's been an honor. Really appreciate it. Say hello to your mother for me.
Of course. And as always, this has been your host of the Epic Entertainment Roundup, saying my lucky numbers are 7 and 3, so stay lucky until next time. And please, please, please go grab 888 Love and the Divine Burden of Numbers. They're selling it on ebooks.com, Walmart, Amazon. You can get it at Barnes & Noble's, Powell's if you're out there in Oregon. But please, please, please go buy it. Thank you so much and have a great night.